This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to an expanded, slightly edited version of my conversation with Andrew Zolli. He is curator and executive director of PopTech and the author of Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. I spoke with Andrew Zolli on February 21st, 2013, from the studios of APM in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was in a private recording studio in New York City. Download the MP3 of that produced show with Andrew Zolli at onbeing.org.
Hello.
Hi. Oh, are we connected?
Thank you.
Great. Can you hear me?
Hi, Andrew. Can you hear me?
You can hear me. I couldn't tell who's...
Tracy's just... She's a reporter for Marketplace. She's hanging out.
Oh, good.
Why don't you move, like, 2 inches to your left, just a little bit. Good? Now up forward just a touch. No. Yeah. Okay, good.
Good. Tracy, good. Do you know Stacy Vanek Smith?
Where are we?
Well, he's getting...
He's in New York.
Me too.
Oh, okay.
Quite well.
Got a little confused about the Marketplace reference.
Oh, he was, yeah. Not talking about you, I don't think.
No, sorry.
Does this, yeah, does this looks a little bit...
High.
Yeah, it looks a little high.
Is that Krista?
Yes.
Hi, Krista. It's Andrew.
Oh, hi, Andrew. Hi. So you're in New York?
I am indeed in the lovely Argo Studios.
Oh, one of my favorite places.
Yeah, very chill. I sort of want a cot. I want to move in. I want a desk.
I'm sure they make you feel at home. Actually, you know, when I think the last time we were there in person, Chris's sister, mm-hmm. I was after we did the 9/11.
Yeah.
We did an event at the week of... We did it like Tuesday night before 9/11. We uplink our show on Wednesday, so we'd been up all night. So I think I have actually fallen asleep in the chairs there in the...
Well, there are worse places to do that in New York City.
And Krista, that fits our business model.
Okay, well, listen, if you ever need an endorsement along those lines, you call me.
Studios and hostels.
That's right. So, Andrew, I want to say one thing to you before we start, which is I'm so excited about this. I loved immersing in your stuff. And you, like me, are a curator of other people's projects and ideas. And we will certainly get into that. But I really want this conversation, I want our framing to be, this is about, you know, how your mind works, you as a thought leader.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, you got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you don't, and I will lead us, so you don't have to worry about that. But I just want to tell you that that's how I'm coming into this.
That's good, actually. I like that as a person who celebrates others professionally.
Exactly. And I know, I understand that completely.
Right.
So we're in a different studio than usual, and I can't see. Are we okay? I can. Should we talk about breakfast or something? Andrew, can you hear Chris?
Yeah.
Okay.
If only I'd had breakfast. What I did was feed a 3.5-year-old and a 1.5-year-old their breakfast. The 1.5-year-old then proceeded to fling it all over me. So.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. But you didn't take it personally. You were resilient.
Of course not. No, are you kidding? Yeah. It's like, I love this. This is great. This is what I signed up for. Right.
Chris, do you need me to talk about breakfast? It's so you always know what I had for breakfast. It's so confusing to me that I can't see you, that there's a monitor between us. But I may just have to lean back every once in a while and lock eyes with you. Okay. I'll look at Dave instead. Okay. All right. Andrew.
Yes.
So happy we're here.
Yeah. Amazed and surprised.
Okay. Well, you may know this. I start all my interviews, whoever I'm talking with, by asking if there was a religious or spiritual background to your childhood.
Very much so. I grew up in a Catholic family in New England. Both of my parents are very active in their church and lead a very active spiritual and religious life. Mm-hmm. And in my own journey through through the world of faith. You know, it's I've touched on lots of different things. I actually at one point sort of flirted in my childhood with the idea that there might be a calling for me there
As a priest.
Well, I wasn't sure. Actually, it's kind of, you know, it's a funny thing. I spent a year at Fordham University in the Bronx with the Jesuits, who I thought were absolutely amazing. They were Jedi Knights.
Yeah, and they are absolutely amazing, those Jedi Jesuits.
It was fascinating because, you know, at that time, that place was the part of it that I really connected with was the social gospel, the idea that, you know, if you can see God anywhere, you can see God in the people. Mm-hmm. And at that point, the liberation theology movement was spreading like wildfire across Latin America, and it was essentially washing back onto the shores of the United States as people were beginning to think about liberation theology movements as they related to communities of color and other structurally marginalized communities, and people were beginning to put structure around those ideas. And the Jesuits at Fordham were actually at the epicenter of that movement at that time, and I found that incredibly compelling. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, you know, my own spiritual worldview is a little more complex than the one I had when I was younger, and a bit broader. I don't want to distract us from our much larger interview. I'm not sure how far you'd like me to go.
We'll come back to this. That's good enough. I just want to get a sense of the background. And in a way, that story you tell about being captured by that movement that was at once spiritual and social and political, it kind of illustrates. There's something you wrote or said in another interview which really intrigued me. And it is, my whole life I've been interested in hybrids, what happens when one field or discipline rubs up against another. And I wondered, you know, where you would trace the origins of that. And when you say always, you know, what's your farthest memory back to that? Where did it start?
Well, you know, so first of all, you know, lots of things happen when ideas rub up against each other. Sometimes they result in baby ideas, and new fields, and sometimes they result in fistfights and grumpiness and you know, other kinds of challenges. But you know, the world is divided into silos of excellence. The people who think about problems, you know, working on an AIDS vaccine, and the people working on new technologies, and the people working on climate change. If you're working on a really tough problem, often you need to know what's been tried, what's failed, what's worked, who's doing the best work.
So I'm curious, like, when did you first start to see that in the world?
Yeah.
How do you think that got planted in you, that way of seeing as much as anything else?
Okay, I'm going to tell you some things that because we have the luxury of tape.
We do, yeah.
In answering some of these questions, I want to share with you a few things that are true about me that are maybe not for the radio.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So let me sort of back up for a moment. Mm-hmm. So when I was a boy, about 6 years old, my mom got cancer, and my father was a kind of traditional, contemporary, pious but not zealous Christian Catholic, and my mother had converted to Catholicism. She'd come from the United Kingdom married him and converted in the process. And when she got sick, people were shielding me. So, you know, as a child, what you pick up on is not the specifics of what's going on, but the kind of ambient anxiety that, you know, children attenuate to just perfectly, even if they don't understand the specifics of what's going on. But what I grew up with was many of the kind of the particulars of faith, the particulars of a kind of fervent religiosity. And it was a real struggle for me. I think what happened was when it washed out of my system, what it left behind was a kind of residue of a deep conviction, a deep spiritual conviction about the world, a deep theological belief about the world or instinct about the world that later in the course of my own journey, I had to reconcile with other things that I knew to be true. You know, the theory of evolution is true. The cosmological history of the universe, the sort of scientific understanding that we have, and reconciling those two led me to a place of a couple basic insights. And one of them was that the molecules in the chair that's currently levitating my rear end sufficiently so that I can speak into the microphone can be carefully rearranged, just very gently rearranged and have a few added molecules and become sensate, which is really an amazing miracle in front of us, right? That the stuff of the universe appropriately organized can turn into you and me. Mm-hmm. That the stuff cannot just become sensate but mindful, and that in the process a kind of deep commandment emerges, which is the commandment to amplify the mindfulness of that stuff, that's really what we are, right? And so in the process of that, which I know sounds a little wafty, that you get to the commandment that really drives both a gratitude, mindfulness, and service. Hmm. So those have been kind of central convictions of most systems of faith,
in one
aspect or another,
with different vocabulary.
Yes, and solving different specific problems.
Yeah.
You know,
the
Christians are trying to solve the problem of sin, and you know, other systems of faith are trying to solve other problems. But so when I was young, to give you that as a kind of background, that's my kind of personal cosmology.
Yeah, just keep going, and we'll talk about what can stay and what needs to go.
Yeah. So you asked me a question about when this interest in hybrids began.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you, I had two early encounters in the world that really shaped the way I see the world. The first one was that when I was a child, I was introduced to the world of the computer. And I was part of that generation of people who got Apple IIs and Commodore 64s, the first generation
new baby computers.
Yes, exactly.
Yes,
computers
yes.
that are so low-powered by uh-huh. today's standards that they're emulated in web pages. They're just they're the weakest thing you can imagine by today's standard. And fascinatingly, you know, we have a couple of children. My oldest daughter is 3.5, and her first experience of computers happened when she was about 9 months old and came from the same company. So two generations, I and my daughter, both affected by computers. Now, the difference is that when I was a child, I was about 13 years old, 12, 13, when we got our hands on that. And those computers were so low-powered that you couldn't just turn them on and use them mm-hmm. the way that my 9-month-old daughter could, before she spoke a single word of English,
right.
pick up my iPad, navigate to an application, turn on a game, and beat me at it before she could say, Daddy.
Right.
But when I was a teenager, the machine was something that you had to work to control, and that revealed its secrets and that revealed something about the nature of code. And it really was an extraordinary universe to be exposed to, the idea that there are sort of algorithms and processes and understanding the language with which those processes are given form was enormously important, because the computer went everywhere in our society. And once you begin to learn to think in code, you start to see code everywhere. Hmm. You see it in just the behavior of stoplights, and you start to see it in flocks of geese, and you start to see it in the changing patterns of waves and air and water. Hmm. And so that was a hugely important part of my early experience before I could fully understand it. And a second one was that when I was in high school, I read philosophy way too early. So I said, I found out that I was like, are you telling me there's a job where I can wear a bedsheet and eat grapes and talk about the nature of the universe? Oh. This is clearly the profession for me. Mm. And so I got very interested in philosophy and began to study at the university level and got very frustrated. And the reason I got frustrated was because it felt like many of the questions that were being asked, particularly about the nature of mind, were questions that we actually had tools to answer.
And is that how you ended up studying? Didn't you study cognitive science in college too?
I did. And I sort of went back and forth between neuroscience, which felt too specific. We're going to spend all of our time essentially poking this neuron with a stick and seeing what happens. Philosophy, which was full of great questions, the kind of questions you wish you had answers to, but none of the tools were answering them. Hmm. And then magically this field had emerged in the middle, which combined neuroscience and artificial intelligence and computer science and linguistics and philosophy of mind. It was a kind of a hybrid field in which people who had a shared interest in the nature of mind and brain were slowly figuring out their own vernacular. And that's a really difficult and long process. It takes a long time for people to realize that, you know, this thing that I mean when I touch my nose is what you mean when you touch your ear, and vice versa, and to sort of develop a shared perspective.
And, you know,
and that set me on my course.
Yeah, and that is such a that just absolutely points at, I think, one of the defining features of the world we are leaving behind, right? We're on this territory with no maps now. I mean, I feel like so many people are waking up to the fact that we are living in the middle of a paradigm change in everything. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you are illuminating in such practical ways is how we specialized in the parts and we didn't see the whole.
Yeah, for the first time, I think, in part because of now the power of some of our new tools and because of advances that were forced upon us by that kind of interdisciplinary thinking, we're now at a point where we can begin to tease apart and see the whole beyond the sum of the individual parts. And it couldn't come soon enough because we're really living in a moment now where really an age of paradox, mm-hmm. in which we are living through the sixth extinction, a huge vertical step change in the size of the human footprint. Fully half of humanity, the humanity that will be here at the end of the 21st century, isn't here now. Mm. So, you know, we moved from a few billion, you know, just to put it in general perspectives, It took 40,000 years plus for us to go from the first people you would recognize at a family reunion to a billion people. And we're going to add the last billion people inside of a decade, sometime in the second half of the 21st century, right, if our models are right. So all of these extraordinary correlated elements are all byproducts of the time of spikes we are living in. We are, you know, the number of species lost, the amount of carbon put into the atmosphere, the amount of water that human beings are using, and on and on and on. All of those curves have gone vertical. But at the same time, and I think this is what makes it a paradoxical moment, is we're also living through a new renaissance. We're producing more insight, knowledge, capacity,
right,
at exactly the same moment that so we're living through a renaissance and an extinction at the same moment, and that is hugely discombobulating,
yes,
for people.
Yes,
it creates inherent, you know, one of the things human beings cherish is coherence, and without coherence you have no wisdom. And we are living through a period in which the seismograph is going bananas, like we're living through an earthquake. And as a byproduct of all of this turbulence, we're the period of turbulence we're in, it's enormously disconcerting for folks. So
yes, I mean, you know, I was speaking at a seminary the other night. I mean, you know, and it's like the world of religious institutions, like the world of all kinds of institutions, is completely imploding. And I think, you know, so one of the ways I think in kind of lay terms about the, as you say, the discombobulation of the moment is we suddenly see that the old forms don't work, the ones we knew, but we don't, we cannot see the contours of the new forms that will succeed them.
In many ways, I actually think the spiritual life of humanity is defined by some of these kinds of externalities. Some philosophers and historians of religious practice look at something called the axial age, the moment when human beings moved into permanent urban settlements.
Around the 4th century BCE.
That's right, the sort of Davidian moment, and Jesus is in some ways a kind of an outlier. Muhammad the same, and so you see within this period, this transition in the shape of human habitation, demographics, the cosmopolitan nature of certain sort of the first market economy of ideas, shifting the relationship between the understanding of God's relationship with the people to a portable relationship with the person, because the person suddenly could move through the social order in a different way. They were less prescribed by the group. And I think in some ways the shape of human habitation is going to change fairly dramatically in our lifetimes, and certainly in our lifetimes and our children's lifetimes. And it is implausible, to say the least, that our spiritual understanding wouldn't follow such a dramatic transition.
Right. And I also think one of the features of the axial age, one of the moves, was a sense that one's well-being could be connected in larger and larger circles, right? That in fact, your tribe, your family, might not be the last word in what you would care about or who you would feel connected to. And that's another thing that our technology is just exponentially taking to a new place again.
That's right. You know, the in the world of social network theory, there's a distinction made between what we think of as strong ties. That's the tie you have to your parents, your children, your neighbor, the person you see every day, the person in whose growth and development and life story you are, you know, intimately involved.
Right.
And weak ties, who are maybe the friends of the people who you are deeply involved with, the people you know less well, but would certainly return your phone call, right? Or know who you are. And I think one of the things that we've seen is that our technologies of connection in this moment enable us to dramatically extend the scope of our weak ties. I have thousands of friends on Facebook and Twitter and all of these other platforms, people that I have some sort of calling card to call on that I don't know well. Mm-hmm. And my ability to maintain close relationships hasn't scaled anything like that, you know. So, in some ways, it's a different social order that we've put ourselves in.
So if we think about, you know, I mean, connection is such an important word, and what we suddenly see in this world we're leaving behind is the disconnection. But we didn't see that before. I mean, you know, the fact that medicine divided our bodies into specialties, right? Or that in social programs or politics or economic development, we focused on solving problems, in fact, as we now see, in isolation. And yet we had this idea that we were going to just achieve, that we could accomplish equilibrium. And so this realm you're working in, I mean, one of the words that you are using and that your thinking and work is associated with now is this, let's call it a new paradigm of resilience. So why don't you talk to me about, you know, how resilience changes the equation in terms of how we see ourselves as human beings and really all of our endeavors?
we're in a moment now as a species, as societies, as communities, at all different levels, where we are experiencing increasing amounts of volatility. And that volatility comes from a couple different places. First of all, there's a lot more of us. And the presence of a lot more of us pushes what we call planetary boundaries. There's a whole group of researchers in Stockholm led by a guy named Johan Rockström who study these core variables that enable life on Earth to continue. And of the nine that these researchers have identified, three are currently sort of pushed into the red, with another four approaching their theoretical limits, the planet's regenerative capacity. But at the same time, we've also connected systems and tightly coupled them to one another. So 10 years ago, we used to marvel, and you could sort of see it entered the culture, that a butterfly could flap its wings on one side of the planet, and you could have a hurricane on the other side of the planet.
Right.
Well, in an era where every butterfly is connected to every hurricane, you start to worry about the flapping of those butterfly wings. How, my goodness, what can we do to stop that from happening? Because the ecological system, the economic system, the geopolitical system, the climate system, the food security system are all connected to each other in ways that cause very complex, highly unpredictable, nonlinear outcomes. And just to pick a story about that, when Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast a few years ago in 2005, it caused the shutdown of the 2,900 oil refineries that dot the Gulf of Mexico preemptively so that they weren't damaged. And that caused a spike in the price of gasoline, which in turn fueled a further boom in ethanol, which Congress got behind for political reasons. And that led to a diversion of the U.S. corn crop increasingly into growing varieties of corn that are used for making fuels instead of feeding people, which in turn yoked the price of corn and the price of oil, which when there was a speculative bubble in the price of oil some 5 years later, caused the price of corn to skyrocket in Mexico, of all places, which is a major importer of corn from the United States, which caused political instability briefly in the country of Mexico. So in that one little crazy chain of events that I just described, we've touched on energy, ecology, geopolitics, the poverty, food, all of those things connected to each other. And nobody in 2005 at all would have said, and no one would have believed them if they were right, you know, 5 years from now, as a result of this hurricane, we're going to have food riots in a country that wasn't even affected by the hurricane.
Right.
So all of those systems being connected in the ways that they are, in complex and unpredictable ways, leads us to a place where increasingly, instead of trying to find an equilibrium in a planet that's out of balance, we also have to try and manage with the unbalances, the imbalances. We have to manage in a world that's intrinsically out of order. And that means protecting especially vulnerable people from the shocks and disruptions that are becoming the hallmark of the age.
So what's interesting here, too, is that when things were in silos and they were in tidy compartments, or we could pretend like they were, it was also easier to pretend that failure and vulnerability and crisis are not completely normal and predictable. There's a way in which there was not a great reality base also. And so what happens with all this interconnection is it amplifies the effects when things, as they always do, in ways we can often not foresee, go wrong.
are absolutely right about that. And the terrible thing is there's plenty of things that we know are going wrong that we can't organize our political will to deal with that sit just adjacent to the much larger pool of things that we don't even know are interconnected here. But what you're pointing to, Krista, it's, I think, a really astute point, is that the history of the 20th century was the history of a huge explosion of human capacity, which continues to this day. Right. But think about what happened. Human lifespan was dramatically extended from 1900 to 2000. A man who was alive in 1900 had a lifespan of about 55 living in the West. By the end of the century, it increased to about 80, which is dramatic.
Yeah,
you know,
really dramatic.
That's almost a different species
yes.
of people
yes.
who can expect to live that long. We mastered the atom. We invented the contemporary information society. We electrified the planet. And against that backdrop, you can sort of forgive human beings for thinking that they were in control.
Right. We can
do it all.
We are going to solve all the problems. Yeah, you can.
That's right.
I think that's great perspective.
Not that we've solved every problem, but that every problem is solvable.
Yes, yes.
And that we just there's the problems we've solved and the ones we haven't gotten to yet.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And so none of this is to mention sending people into outer space and dramatically extending our sensor network as a species out into our solar system and everything else. So I think what has happened is that now there is a kind of shift to humility.
Mm-hmm.
And we really saw this in the community that I work in about 5 or 6 years ago, before the financial crisis of 2008.
In Brooklyn, do you mean?
Well, not just in Brooklyn, but in this community of scientists and technologists and engineers.
This universal community. Was that this big, wide community?
Right. Well, mm-hmm. My day job is running an organization called PopTech that brings people working in these fields together.
Yeah.
And so it affords us a unique perspective to see what people working at the edges of all these fields are thinking about. And very subtly, over the course of several years, you could see the language start to shift. And the shift in language, and it was really a shift in emphasis as much as language,
right.
was away from risk mitigation. That is to say, what are the steps we can do or take to ensure that we steer around crises? Toward risk adaptation, which is to say, my goodness, there's no way we can steer around these storms. We had better build a better boat. And when corporate leaders and governmental leaders and scientists and social innovators and all of these folks begin to talk about the same thing, not using the same language, but the same kind of shift. It was like watching the wind blow over the grass. You could just see all the blades sort of shift their polarity. You knew it was a really big shift that was underway.
Can you remember a person or a moment or some time when this really became clear to you or struck you? It's okay if you can't, but I'm just wondering.
Well, gosh, there are a lot of relevant moments.
Yeah.
I think about this moment that we had. I was with a farmer in Kenya. So Kenya is a country that is largely fed by smallholder farmers who are growing very small plots of land. And one of the things that's happened in the Horn of Africa is climate effects have dramatically shifted the pattern of the rains and the pests and what crops can grow, and it's caused all kinds of volatility and real disruption, and not just for farmers in general, but particularly for women and girls who make up the majority of those farmers.
Hmm.
And so I was talking to I remember talking to a woman there who was a farmer, and she was – this is not someone who had access to lots of education and not someone who had access to lots of resources. And she was describing the difficulties because they were gearing up for whether or not they needed to move, which meant for her moving
right.
away from schools and clinics that
right.
had fixed infrastructure that had been put in place by big multinational aid agencies and the government. And potentially disrupting her future. And she looked right at me and she said, you're coming here to study me, but I have to tell you, I am your future. And what she meant was the stuff that's happening here is going to happen everywhere.
Right.
And, you know, you had this moment where that sort of that moment when you look at somebody and the whole context within which you're having the conversation, which is you're the wealthy visitor,
right,
who is there to understand the context, is suddenly put into the same tribe. The tribe is enlarged, and the two of you are in it together.
Right.
And you realize that you really are connected by that web of mutuality and shared destiny.
And that, in fact, your future well-being might depend very much on how much you learn from her.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, one of the byproducts of the great explosion of 20th century knowledge is that we got used to this idea that the flow of innovation goes from west to east and from north to south. It basically radiates out of Silicon Valley and everyone else picks it up,
right?
Radiates out of the United States. And so I think one of the byproducts of this period of volatility is that we're going to see a lot of innovation that flows south to south, south to north, east to west. It's going to go everywhere because we need innovations that are happening in Kenya now, here in the United States. And we need to think about these kinds of disruptions. In New York City, where I live, we just had a giant hurricane.
Yes.
And one way to think about that hurricane is that it's a giant developmental leveler, because in the days afterwards, the context within which we lived, which was no electricity and flooding and food insecurity, are the daily lived experiences of many people who are more vulnerable on a systemic basis all over the world. And they have real things to tell us about how to deal with that. So it's a sense that that we see that the next great wealth, I think, is going to be made by people who are helping us import solutions from other places around the world and address some of the byproducts of the huge expansion of the human footprint.
And I just want to kind of underline this before we, you know, keep moving on, but it's something you said that's so striking is that one of the things we need are systems that fail gracefully, that don't bring down everything else. And I think that sentence, you know, for almost everyone, you think about the economic downturn of 2008, you think about Hurricane Katrina, and it makes sense. But this notion of failing gracefully, I mean, it's a sentence that is true in life as well.
Yeah, that's right.
And yet we haven't wanted to think that it would be true in our institutions, in the way we manage and organize our common life. It's scary.
I think that's true. And I think part of the reason is that I think we believed that we could essentially out-engineer failure.
Right, right.
That we could inoculate ourselves from it. I'll speak about my own personal journey. My first independent decade as an adult was in the 90s. And so it's interesting to reflect on what was going on then, right? The Soviet Union had collapsed.
Yes.
We weren't at war. The internet was ascendant. People were publishing books with titles like The End of History.
Yes.
It was over. It was like a party that I just arrived at and everyone was going home, which is not the last time that would happen in my life. And so the idea was that it was going to be, you know, clear and easy sailing, and that our fights were going to be about economics and creativity, and they weren't going to be over physical resources, and they weren't going to be real wars. We were moving past that.
Right,
period.
There was going to be nothing that went downward. Everything would go upward.
That's right. People were writing books with titles like Dow 36,000, you know.
Right.
So the laws of physics had been repealed. And we were busy spending our peace dividend, and we could invest enormous amounts of time on the sexual picadillos of leaders and things like that. There was a sense of that it wasn't quite as consequential. Now, contrast that to the decade that came right after, that in many people's minds began with a spectacularly successful global act of terrorism, proceeded through huge, expensive, complicated, painful, shocking wars and natural disasters, and concluded with a huge economic crisis. I believe that historians years from now will find that the this decade is going to replace the 70s as the suckiest decade in American history. You know, it's not the one that we're all going to love, but the most important thing is that we moved from a period of relative tranquility to real disruption in basically the blink of an eye. Mm-hmm. And that fact has begun to permeate our culture. And so you asked about graceful failure. I think the first premise is all things fail. And in fact, not only do all things fail, but failure is intrinsic, healthy, normal, and necessary most complex systems. People who study the resilience of ecological systems often talk about a model that was developed in the 1970s by a guy named Buzz Hollings called the adaptive cycle, and in which, if you think about something like an old growth forest, the system moves from a period of shoots coming out of the ground that are not very efficient and not deeply connected to each other. But if that forest manages to continue to grow, it grows into a very, very powerful instrument in the aggregate for converting and storing carbon and nutrients. Lots of different kinds of plants grow into the kind of forest that we like to walk around in, you know, the kind of like sequoia, old growth, beautiful forest that are very efficient as a system. And this is the other point. They're very interconnected, and the plants all grow at different sizes so that they can maximize their capture of sunlight. However, in a system like that, which is the one that we are, our innate biophilia leads us to want to spend time in, if there isn't an occasional fire, to reorganize the system, then what happens is the faster growing, more less fire resistant trees overtake and then kill off the slower growing but more fire retardant trees, and then when a spark occurs, you get a big boom, which is what happens in California, or think about the Colorado, these huge wildfires that in part are exacerbated because human beings don't let smaller fires happen. We don't do controlled burns very well. So the necessity of systemic reorganization to most systems, the necessity of failure is essential. And then the question is, if that's true, how can we weather such failures? And a big part of that story is about emboldening the local. Because we've so tightly connected all of these systems, it's important that we have redundancy. It's important that we have spare capacity. It's important that we have the right kinds of social networks so that we can share with each other. It's important that we have a shared wisdom, a body of knowledge that helps us be more locally self-reliant.
You're talking about human wisdom as well as wisdom, wise infrastructure, wise, right? You're talking about relationship and, yes, wisdom in that with a capital W.
Yeah, I mean the we need systems where much as in your body, you know, a clot in a very tiny clot in exactly the wrong place, the wrong time, can kill you. And we need the kinds of infrastructure. It's a manifold problem. It exists in lots of different domains and scales, but one of the things that cuts across them is we need systems that can self-reorganize, that are better at sensing emerging disruption. We need systems that encourage cooperation rather than division. We need systems that where a failure in one component of the system doesn't bring down every other component of the system. Those are really, in many ways, they're sort of a design brief for the 21st century. And they're, you know.
And I think something that is provocative and maybe controversial that grows out of this is, I think the word sustainability arose as an initial response to the realization that the way we'd been doing things wasn't holistic enough. But you're also saying, you and other people are saying, that sustainability fell into some of the same traps, and that, that resilience really is, again, something different. I mean, you were just describing that, too. But how would you describe that distinction?
Well, first of all, I think it's very important to say that sustainability has been an enormously important galvanizing, not just conceptual principle, but a political principle to guide policy and ideas. And essentially, the way that we think about this is to imagine for a moment, and if you're listening to this on the radio, you know, and driving a car, don't close your eyes and imagine it. Just imagine that we're putting all the people who care about an issue like climate change in a car, and we send that car headed toward the cliff of irrevocable disruption, real change, really undesirable systemic change. As like Thelma and Louise, right? We're sending them off the cliff. So when the car is far from the cliff, the people who have moral authority in the car say things like stop, slow down, turn the wheel, hit the brakes. Those are exactly the right moral and proper thing to do at that moment, because if you're headed toward a cliff and you don't want to go over it, those are the things you should say. But because prophets are rarely listened to in their own time, and because paradoxically there's actually time between the time when the car is where the car is now and the cliff, it becomes somebody else's problem. In politics and in Washington, there's actually a great acronym called NIMTO, which is not in my term of office, right? Okay. That is an important problem, but it's going to be my successor's problem, right? Let someone else solve that. Well, the car keeps headed in the direction of the cliff, and as the car gets close to the cliff, there's another group of people who come to the fore, and they say things like, you know, we'd better put an airbag and some parachutes on this thing because there are vulnerable people in the car and down below us, and we don't want them to get hurt or killed. And that's the right and moral proper thing to say at that time. And in between the two, there is a shift. And sometimes it's a complex shift. In environmental circles, for instance, for years, it was verboten to talk about adaptation, because if we adapt to the malignant use of petrochemicals, for instance, or hydrocarbons, then we're giving a pass to the current system, or we're locking in the current system. And that has been a long fight. Sustainability as a concept has actually been with us now for about four decades, and it's been – that's a very long time in the public life of ideas. And it's predicated on the idea, which remains true to this day, that human beings must find a way to live in balance with the planet, because we do not want to suffer our own collapse, from just a purely self-interested perspective. But it's also true today, and wasn't true, say, in the 1960s, that now we are actually inheriting the consequences of our own inaction.
Right.
And you know, it is not a future tense problem. It is a present tense problem. Mm-hmm. So set of problems. So now we actually have to figure out what are we going to do, not to change and steer away from the storm, but to steer through it. And we have incredible hat trick. We've just given ourselves the toughest agenda, which is that we have to at once try to build and harden our boat to make it through the storm storms plural, the things that are coming at us and are going to come at us with greater frequency and greater cost for years to come. This is not going away. And at the same time, we also have to figure out how to work our way backwards out of the storm. And that's expensive. And it requires complex compromises, and because resources aren't infinite.
Right.
So sustainability tries to get the world back into balance. Resilience thinks about managing in a world that's inherently out of balance. And the two, I think, sometimes complement each other, and sometimes they compete with each other. But we're going to be talking about both of them for a long time.
So, you know, something that intrigues me about one implication of this way of thinking, especially this image and this example you just gave, is this notion of resilience also challenges, I would say, the political silos, the silo-driven way we have talked about change or compromise or solutions. Some of the language and the realities we need to aspire to address some of our great crises, not just environmental, our great challenges like peace and justice and environmentalism, you know, have in themselves become divisive, politicized categories. Hmm. And, you know, one of the things you've said that, again, thinking that comes out of this posture of resilience is there are good guys and bad guys and good ideas and bad ideas, but we, as you say, in this moment where many challenges and crises are upon us, we have to acknowledge that holy war against bogeymen hasn't worked and isn't likely to anytime soon. In its place, we need approaches that are both more pragmatic and more politically inclusive, rolling with the waves instead of trying to stop the ocean. So how do you think about how this model of resilience, as you know it now from social change agents and scientists, you know, how would it inform and challenge our public life, including each of us as political beings?
Well, it's a great question. Immediately, there's a few things to say. So when you find resilience, paradoxically, there are no 7 R's of resilience. It's not a checklist. You do these 7 things.
I don't think those checklists ever work anyway. So
right,
I'm glad to hear you say that.
Yeah, but they particularly don't work. And that's a problem because, of course, you know, our government works by checklists.
Well, right? Also, we like them. I mean, they're handy to have for all of us.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But particularly given the complexity of these things, really what we need to talk about are trade-offs. So let me start with one aspect of a trade-off that we make in our current political system,
Okay. Which
is that there's a trade-off between the agility that comes with short-term thinking and wisdom that comes from long-term thinking. So one of the challenges of our contemporary structure, political structure, is that the political incentives, among people who have short-term cycles, political cycles, we're talking about Congress people, for instance, mean that there's virtually no incentive for most people in Congress to solve long-term problems because the political rewards will accrue to someone else, right? And it's hard to sell umbrellas in the sunshine. It's hard to prove to your constituents that
Right. Instead
of doing something that was in their immediate interest, you took out an insurance policy to make sure that they would be okay when a hypothetical event, which might not actually occur, happens. Mm-hmm. And there's enormous rewards for disgorging funds and acting in the immediate wake of a disruption. So, you know, it's 15 times more expensive to deal with big disasters like we had Hurricane Sandy here in the Northeast than it would have been to put in place the systems to let people deal with them beforehand and mitigate the risk. But the political rewards for disgorging huge sums of money are huge, and there's virtually no rewards for prevention. Now, that's not true uniformly across what you might think of as a broader definition of our government. So there are places in our government that do have long memories and that do therefore have long points of view. Paradoxically, they're in places like the permanent bureaucracy, parts of the State Department, and even the military. And, you know, here's an interesting example of this that just runs directly counter to many of our kind of typical notions. So the nature of war has changed. That was one of the big things that happened, particularly in the shift in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we no longer have wars where there's a line, and everyone on one side of the line is on one team, and everyone on the other side of the line is on the other.
And they all wear identifiable uniforms.
That's right. That's right. So now we live in a world in which we have forward operating bases in territory that is hostile in 360 degrees, right? And they're connected in a kind of network pattern. And supplying these forward operating bases is really expensive. At the height of the war in Afghanistan, the cost of a gallon of gasoline was $400 a gallon. And that includes the cost of shipping it through very dangerous passageways through Pakistan and through Afghanistan, through enemy territory, where we would have to bribe our enemies not to blow up the convoys that were carrying fuel to our own troops who were fighting them, which you can imagine is quite expensive. So we're basically paying people not to fight themselves, you know, or something. So that's part of the crazy world we live in.
Right.
But the important thing about this is that there's a huge incentive for the military to figure out how to decarbonize, that is, to use less gasoline, to become more energy self-sufficient, to become greener. In fact, they're investing huge amounts of R&D into how to use solar technologies. There was a plan in place in Afghanistan to encourage opium poppy farmers to grow biofuel crops instead, so that the government could harvest them and run their military operations on biofuels that were locally harvested. So here you have, the department of blowing things up and killing people talking about local self-sustaining energy ecologies. Now, granted, for a very specific purpose that, you know, is, it doesn't strike us as being, particularly peaceful per se. But the point is that they have to think about the world in much longer time increments than the typical congressperson.
Right.
So, and that's true in our State Department. It's true in other parts of our government, which are not subject to the same kinds of turnover. And the broader point is this, that when you talk to the broader point I'd say is that there are always trade-offs. So, for example, when you talk to corporations, one of the things they say is that we have to produce our quarterly earnings estimate every quarter, and often more frequently than that, they have to change their behavior to make sure they make their number to satisfy their shareholders. We wish we could take a longer-term view. And then you talk to nonprofit NGOs, people like the Red Crosses of the world, and they say, we can't move very quickly. We wish we could move much faster. So there's a little bit of the grass is greener.
Right.
And what you really see in resilient systems is the ability to move at more than one speed. It's the ability to have more than one time signature. And there are other heuristics of resilience. So, for example, diversity really matters in a system. Cooperation really matters in a resilient system. The ability to sense the truth around the system, that is to say, building in sensors so that they can adapt to changing conditions, whether those are communities, individuals, or big complex systems. So you see these heuristics that come up again and again and again. And we saw this work. We traveled from the coral reefs of Palau to the back streets of Palestine, looking at the emerging heuristics of resilient systems. And there is a kind of design vocabulary there that I think we're going to be baking into the way we build our cities, the way we bolster our communities, the way we think about ourselves for decades to come.
So let's talk about then this.
That was a bit rambling. I'm sorry.
No. Don't worry. Look, the great thing about this is there's real conversation. We have 90 minutes, which is a huge luxury, and real conversations ramble.
Yeah,
but
that's
No, that was good. But I'm not. So I want you to kind of. I wonder if you would walk us into this universe you're part of, this, you know, you said we, where did you say we've gone from Palau to Palestine? And anything, and you're probably talking about PopTech that there. I mean, that you, PopTech is a hub of collaborative networks and people and communities, creative networks and people and communities. Resilience is one of the framing notions. So, I mean, just first of all, how did you discover PopTech? It was founded, when was it founded? 1996, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, that's right.
Were you there right at the beginning?
No, I was invited into this tribe. PopTech's really an amazing entity in that it really is the manifestation in its founding of the values of a very specific community, a very particular place. And this one is on the coast of Maine in a little village called Camden of a few thousand people, which happens to be the epicenter of a really wonderful creative community. Hmm. And it's about 3 hours north of Boston and full of not just the kind of New England village lobstermen that you might anticipate, but poets and writers and photographers and creative types in many years ago, the people in the community started a conference which continues to this day called the Camden Conference, which is held in February when no one who is optionally associated with Maine is in the state, because Maine in February is not easy. And it gave the community something to do and a way to talk, to bring ideas into itself. So, you know, this is a real community with real values and like many small communities, with lots of interdependent parts. You know, you find people working two or three jobs, and so you see the same person at the library and you see them again at a shop and you see them in a restaurant and you know, like all small communities, it can be challenged by the larger winds of change. And so the citizens of this community started a movement to start their own way of bringing the world to them. Hmm. And it flourished during the height of the dot-com boom of the 1990s. And I should say, as the dot-com boom was getting started, a group of them said, we should start one that's just about technology and the way in which technology shapes people's lives. Not about the technology itself, but about its impacts. Mm. And that's where PopTech came from. And I came to it in late 2002 when, in the wake of 9/11 and the recession and the fact that the dot-com boom had ended, it was in a challenging moment, and I, along with a wonderful team of people, led its resurgence. And in so doing, something really amazing happened, which is as we started to bring these scientists and technologists and engineers and designers and people working in fields that were so new they didn't have a name. One of the highest compliments we can give someone is to call them a weirdo.
right.
because the reality is the future often belongs to the weirdos. Mm. And so something really amazing started to happen, which is that all of these collaborations started to occur and people started to do stuff. We could barely stop them. So, what's going on here? All of these people kind of saying, we're going to start this project or start this company, and we've decided to work on this problem together. And so we began to put in place the infrastructure to identify, train, refine, scale those collaborations. Today, we run fellows programs where we identify and train some of the world's best next generation of talent in social and ecological change. We train working scientists to become better communicators and collaborators and leaders. We work, that network works in more than 100 countries and serves the lives of some 300 million people. And once a year, they all come to this little village in Maine, and right. They come back together to share each other's work. And I think part of what makes it work is the sense that we're really in somebody's home. And you
there
act
is,
differently.
There's that paradox, right? There's that paradox of our time, another paradox of of something that is global and dynamic, and somehow part of the roots of that and the source of that is that planted, that local sense of place, as you say.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely essential. In particular, in the, you know, if there's a truism about the digital world, it's that it makes the analog world more, not less valuable.
Right.
It makes our FaceTime more important,
right.
Because something happens when you take people out of their everyday urban context or their daily experience, and you put them in the context of a community, their humanity emerges and reemerges, and they touch a space of creative possibility that I think is something that, unfortunately, in many of our cubicleville daily lives, is sort of drummed out of us.
Yeah.
You know, we're taught to edit ourselves, to bring only a narrow keyhole of ourselves often to our professional work. And this whole endeavor and network is predicated on a much more expansive notion of who we are. And so today we have engaged in amazing work in everything from public health issues like HIV to helping to build the entrepreneurial system in places where it's urgently needed, like in the Middle East, where there's a very strong need for the infrastructure for people to start new ventures and to be able to use their gifts to forward their societies,
you know,
which was much of the backdrop of the crisis in the Arab Spring.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, one of the I love the language that you use that PopDeck uses to describe what it does. I love uncovering unusual suspects, and also this, you know, this notion of you bringing together innovators to expand the edge of change, which you know, drawing on what we have, where we began this conversation. That's the work, and maybe that's the best you can do. Rather than solve all the problems, you can expand that edge of change.
Yeah. You know, so we've learned a lot about how technology and innovation happens. So maybe one way to think about it is like this. On a timeline, many of us are familiar with a kind of upward accelerating curve of technology. You know, the first computer, the computer that took humanity to the moon is less powerful than the computer that's in my wristwatch. And, you know, and that curve takes us to more and more powerful computers and bigger data and more insights. And it accelerates the speed with which we can decode genomes and the speed with which we can understand not just the cosmological, but also the biological, the ecological. So that is part of that. We're living in a period where that curve is going vertical and upward. But there is a companion curve that's less well appreciated, and that is the sort of cost per unit of technology, which plummets. So the first megabyte costs you millions of dollars. The next one costs you $100,000. The next one costs you $10,000. And I have 64 gigabytes of memory in my phone, and tomorrow that's going to look quaint.
Right.
Now, when innovation becomes really inexpensive, a couple things happen. First of all, lots more people get to participate.
Yeah, I mean, this is such an inspiring way to talk about the upside of technology, too. You know, we talk a lot about the downside of technology.
Of course, yeah.
But this...
Well, this part of it is, I think, really exciting because, first of all, that's the trend that puts a mobile device in people's hands. That's the trend that... It actually changes the way the normal flow that is undertaken when you have an idea. So when innovation is expensive, the first thing you do, and this is part of most entrepreneurs' journeys up until now, is I have this brilliant idea, and the first thing I have to do is write up a plan to make it so attractive to the bank to loan me the money to try it, right?
Yeah.
Well, now what people are doing is they're coming up with a really brilliant idea. They're taking it to a fab lab, which is a place where you have all the machinery and tools to actually execute that object or that thing, and then putting it on Kickstarter and getting a whole bunch of people involved in saying, yes, I want to see you go forward and becoming customers before they even have a plan, and then going to the bank only at the end. And we're living through this enormous explosion in creativity that is enabled by that low-cost innovation. Mm. And it's not just among techies and those kinds of folks. It's also enabled in places like the informal economy. There are incredible – where there is incredible ingenuity and knowledge but not access – the same kinds of access to tools. So that is the great democratic participatory upside of technology. So at this moment, we have this accelerating capacity. We have rapidly decelerating cost. And we have these increasingly urgent contexts like climate change and all these others, which are the problems we need to solve that are all converging in the moment that we're in. And so we're building a community of Jedi Knights and people who are just amazing, who often speak a language that of their own invention, because they're weirdos, to say it again. They're having to invent language where there is none.
And I always come back to human nature, because that's a particular focus of mine. Another, we've been talking about all these interesting creative tensions and paradoxes of our time. And another one is that I think the urgency of many of these things we sense, it's not just the environment, it's the fact that the economy is not working the way it's supposed to, and politics isn't working the way it's supposed to, and education isn't working the way it's supposed to. Things really close to home for people. But the magnitude of change that you just described, the magnitude and the pace of it, we're not hardwired for that as creatures, right? As human beings, biologically, it's very stressful. In that context, I also see you talking about resilient mind, and I'd like to hear more about that, because one of the discoveries that we've made as a species, I think, in the last few years, and I know you write about this a lot too, that is just so emboldening and thrilling, is this reality of neuroplasticity, that in fact we can change our minds and our brains and our through our behavior and maybe even our genetics, that we have power over who we are in the world in a way that we didn't know before. Mm. But I think that you're also working with people who are working on tools for supporting that.
Yeah. So first of all, to put this a little bit in context, so at a practical level, the resilience frame is really coming into focus in really three different areas that are all really important for today. So the first one is there's the resilience of big complex systems, economies and social ecological systems. These are systems that are not typically mediated by individual human decision, on a moment-to-moment basis.
Right.
They're too big and complex for that. So economists and ecologists and systems theory folks are beginning to really think about how do we help those kinds of systems absorb disruptions that are necessary and sometimes unforeseeable. There's a second thread, which is about the resilience of places. And here we mean cities and varieties of habitats for human beings in particular. How do we embolden the physical places of the earth to better handle occasional disruptions? And the paradox there is that cement is not a terribly resilient material.
Right.
And so we're built, much of what we've built is very robust, but not necessarily very resilient. But there is this third piece, and that is an incredibly exciting new dialogue in the social sciences among psychologists, neuroscientists, social scientists, organizational theorists about what makes us resilient, or less so, in the face of potentially traumatic circumstances.
Right.
What is a trauma is often in the eye of the beholder. But there is a this is you know, obviously a vitally important discussion. So the short answer is there are many things that make you or I and the people we know and everyone we know more or less resilient psychologically, psychosocially. Your social networks, the quality of your intimate relationships, the degree to which you both love and experience love, your access to other kinds of resources, physical resources, your physical health, your genes, and in particular, the interaction between your genes and your life experiences, what's called the GXE
right.
Hypothesis, which is the complex interactions between potentially traumatic events and the on and off switches that drive our genes through our lives. And all of these things play an important role. And the good news is there's really two really important pieces of good news. The first one is that human beings are surprisingly resilient, particularly when you look at us at a population scale.
Right.
There's a researcher named George Bonanno at Columbia who studies the experiences of people, whole populations of people who all go through the same traumatic, potentially traumatic event. So, for instance, all the people who were in the towers on when the planes hit on 9/11, all of the people in a platoon or a battalion who go through a very traumatic experience during times of war, populations of doctors and first responders and those kinds of folks. And what he finds is that resilience, that is to say, a kind of longer-term psychological immunity to the terrible downsides of psychological trauma associated with these events is much more prevalent than we realize. Often between a third and two-thirds of any given population seems to have no lasting ill effects. That doesn't mean they don't feel sadness. It doesn't mean that they don't feel grief. It's
right.
that they're not compromised in their function. So that's very good news. The question that raises, of course, is what do you do for the folks who are not in a particular context psychologically resilient? And there's another piece of good news, and that is that we're beginning to understand the way that new tools can and new aspects of mental habits can play a role in bolstering our resilience. And I'll mention two important parts of that.
I like that term, mental habits. That's good.
Yeah, that's right. It's training ourselves and our brains in a slightly different way to process especially the emotional content of lived experience.
Hmm.
Now, there's two aspects. So first of all, I want to talk about the belief side of that. So it turns out there's a field of research called hardiness research where social scientists
learning
study
all kinds of things from you.
Exactly. I would love to work in this field. I think it's great. So people who are psychologically hardy, it turns out, believe very prevalently some things about the world. So if you believe that the world is a meaningful place, if you see yourself as having agency within that world, and if you see successes and failures as being placed in your path to teach you things, you are more likely to be psychologically hardy and therefore more resilient in the face of trauma.
Hmm.
This is one reason why some researchers that we've spent time with postulate that systems of faith have been so resilient themselves in human history and so prevalent, so sticky, because the individual content of the beliefs, whether you believe in Brahma, Buddha, you know, Allah, or the like, or any particular belief about within those cosmologies is is strictly true or not, but because believing those kinds of things are the very kinds of things that confer psychological resilience upon us, which is why, on average, people with systems of faith or personal cosmologies have been found to be more psychologically resilient than those who don't. And we're not talking about huge differences, right. But they're statistically significant.
Did you have a second point? Yeah, make your second point, then I'll respond.
Yeah, so we'll come back to this.
Okay, you know, yes, we will.
You can't talk to Krista Tippett about that without expecting a follow-up.
Right.
But I'll mention this other one, and that is about the habits of mind. One of the things that we've discovered is that we can train ourselves to change the way we think about and experience potentially traumatic events. And that requires us to think slightly differently about our emotions than our kind of folk psychology notions of emotionalism. So, for example, most of us, myself included, think about emotions as the character, the color of our reactions to events. So, you know, I'm a fairly equanimitable guy and I'm speaking in a highly moderated tone here on public radio to you, and you'd think I'm a very zen fellow until someone cuts me off on the highway, at which point I become fairly homicidal, and I'm glad none of my following comments therefore are on the record after that. I'm glad no one's tape recording me. But the idea is that there's a stimulus, someone cuts me off, and I have a reaction.
Okay.
And what the researchers, and there's many of them now working on the neuroscience of resilience, think about emotions in a slightly different way, which is that instead of thinking about them as reactions, think about them like you have a reserve of something called emotiononium, and it's a cup, right? And when you have an emotional reaction, if you can be judicious in how much of that reserve you spend, then you can invest the resources in that emotional reserve over the course of a day, a week, a month, a year, all the time cycles we live in. And that where real damage comes is when we exhaust our emotional reserve, and then our emotions can't cushion our interpretations. And in the process, that's when real potential post-traumatic stress kinds of issues emerge. And so a group of pioneering researchers has started with a guy named Richie Davidson at University of Wisconsin, but has continued.
We've had him on the show, too.
Many researchers have begun to understand the power of contemplative practices in allowing people to more conscientiously decide how they're going to spend their emotional reserves in high-stress environments.
Right.
So now we're teaching firefighters and first responders and emergency room physicians and soldiers how to attend to their experience and pay attention to it using tools that are really, in many ways, kind of secularized Buddhist contemplative practices. But, you know, just to give you one example of where it's going, there's a wonderful group of researchers led by a guy named Thaddeus Pace at Emory University, and they recently took a group of foster children from the Atlanta DCS, Department of Children's Services system, who by definition had all experienced a traumatic event. They'd all been taken from their families by the state, and taught them compassion-based cognitive therapy, which is a version of this contemplative practice. And what they found was amazing. Two really important outcomes. The first one is that on various experimental measures of their psychological resilience, their psychological resilience was indeed dramatically bolstered by these mental habits that they were trained to follow. But also, in their bodies, in our bodies, there is a protein called the C-reactive protein. It's a biomarker, which means it's an indicator of cellular inflammation. So our cells inflate. It's part of our sort of related to our immunological response or to the way in which our bodies heal. And if the cellular inflammation process goes haywire, as it often does under stress, it's correlated over the long term with things like diabetes and cancer. Right. These are long-term health issues. So the way in which stress affects our long-term health is it affects the inflammation mechanisms. One of the ways is it affects the cellular inflammation mechanisms in our bodies. And when Pace and his colleagues looked at the C-reactive protein levels of these children who had gone through the process of being given compassion-based cognitive therapy, their C-reactive protein levels plummeted as well. So what you see is you're not just helping them in the near term deal with the psychological stresses of continued trauma and vulnerability, you're actually bolstering, you may be preventing a heart attack they're not going to have until they're 55.
Right. Wow. I want to ask, can we keep going for 15 more minutes? Yeah. Okay, good. Are you okay to keep going?
Because we're covering,
all right, because we're covering big ideas and places we have to get that we're not close to. So, all right, good. Okay.
Don't worry.
Just keeping the way we are. So, on this idea of faith traditions and resilience, it strikes me on so many levels that there are echoes here with these cutting edge things we're learning. As you said, that these traditions have helped people see the world as a meaningful place with themselves having agency in it. But also, I think that there's a realism about the human condition and actually a sophisticated analysis of the human condition in Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, when we talked earlier about the kind of idealism that was at the basis of our perfectionism and ambition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, our traditions have always told us that suffering is part of life and that you live through it and, in fact, have the opportunity to grow through it, that change is inevitable, that we will fall short even when we are reaching for our highest ideals. It's striking to me to see that. And, I mean, you used the word humility. You talked about these observations we're making about how the world, in fact, works. And how we have power to make change and how we don't, that it's a rediscovery of humility. It's just very interesting to me.
You know, so I agree with you. And certainly the story here is complex, right? Because systems of faith are great repositories for life lessons. And if you think about, I'll stick with the tradition I know best. If you were to take, as Jefferson tried to take, the kind of metaphysics out of the Bible,
right,
what you're left with is you're left with an operating manual
for
running a pretty good society. And if people are honest with each other and if they're kind to one another and if we look after the weakest among us, there are aggregate effects that come from enlarging the tribe, fostering cooperation and trust, and particularly across lines of diversity that are really essential to the resilience of those communities when things go wrong. Now, on the other hand, it's also important to note that many of those very same systems of faith have been used for exclusionary purposes.
Yeah,
they've
absolutely.
Been used to draw lines, not erase them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think we have to be honest about where we are with them. But there's no question to me that properly understood, these systems of faith are great repositories of resilience thinking. they require us to take the other seriously because we may often be in their place.
Right.
If you think about in the Christian system, again, I just pick it because I know it the best. There's Jesus's sermons in which he says the first shall be last. Right, the blessed are the meek and the poor.
Right.
What he's and it's going to be hard for you guys with your Ferraris to get through the front gates of the Burly Gates. what he's doing is he's saying that this particular arrangement between the two of you is temporary and can be reversed. And in that process, properly understood, what you if the kind of ensuing behavior, and it's certainly the behavior you saw in the earliest followers of these faiths and in Christianity in particular was deep service, was a connection to ennobling the weakest among societies, and those are exactly the kinds of things that bolster the resilience of those places. My favorite example, and one we were really fortunate to follow, was a project that you may have even covered on this program before, called the Abraham Path, which was started by a famous
Poptech is involved in Abraham Path.
No. This is another program.
Okay.
It was started by a team led by a famous negotiator named Bill Urey at Harvard, who ran the Harvard program on negotiation. And he was thinking about – he was being asked to think – negotiation is an interesting subject because it negotiation is when you negotiate with someone, at the end of a successful negotiation, you cooperate, right? Now, that doesn't mean you hold hands and you trip through the daisies and everything's wonderful. It means you come to an agreement on what the two of you are going to do or what the parties are going to do. And – he was asked to think about the cooperation in the Middle East in a place that is rife with cycles of defection, right, in which people not only don't cooperate but they seek out opportunities to annihilate each other. And he said, you know, the thing about these three communities, Christians, Muslims, and Jews in this region is that they all share a common liturgical heritage in the sense that they're all children of Abraham.
Yes.
And so he started this thing, this project called the Abraham Path, which is a long pilgrimage path that retraces the steps of Abraham and in the process takes you through Christian, Muslim, and Jewish communities. And the thing that those communities share is they share a very deep culture of hospitality. When you show up, you're invited in. They make you dinner. And if there's a wedding going on, you get invited.
Right.
And we had that experience when we were working on the book, Anne-Marie Healy and I. And so there's this very deep idea that Urey and his colleagues worked on, which was when you have defections and tribalism, the answer is to enlarge the tribe. It's to redefine the boundary so that we're all in the same camp. And that camp might be we're all children of the book. That camp is...
That's hard, though. It's challenging, especially when it's layered on top of decades or centuries of grievance and... violence.
Yes, and much of it justified much of it terrible. So this is not a silver bullet. Mm-hmm. Rather, it's a manifestation of a strategy for encouraging cooperation across those lines, which is how do you encourage people? How do you nudge compassion and cooperation? There are... this very important work happening now on how we do that at a neuroscientific level, how we do it at a psychosocial level, how we do it at a structural level. One of the things that systems of faith, humbly understood, I think, encourage us to do is to really encounter the other.
Mm-hmm.
And in that encounter, see ourselves in the other, and that is the root from which compassion, cooperation, and many other resilience-enhancing strategies and behaviors emerge.
So Andrew, how do you think, how do you take what you learn about all of this into your life, you know? How do you think you take in events differently? How do you think you might be different as a spouse or a parent or a leader? I know it's a big question, but what comes to mind?
So It's a good question,
It's a challenging question.
Good questions are challenging questions, but this one in particular, I will share a little bit of my personal story. So, you know, I decided to work on this project starting in 2007, and
the resilience project.
Sort of got going in 2007, and just with the idea. Mm-hmm. Remember 2007, we were on an upward trajectory and everything was fabulous. And you remember the stock market was booming.
I vaguely remember that.
Yes, exactly. It's hard. It's amazing how quickly things fade. So in 2007, we could start to see the patterns of this new frame begin to emerge. And then at the beginning of 2008, I had my business partner and the person who was my kind of closest working collaborator at the time, he got sick. We thought, he had a cold, and actually he had a brain tumor.
Was he also young?
He was in his 50s.
Very young. Very young. Yeah.
And he was in his prime, and he passed very suddenly. That was the beginning of 2008. And then a little bit after that, my wife and I lost a baby. And then a little bit after that, we had the global financial crisis hit, and it felt like it was raining hammers. And I just decided to write a book about resilience. And I began to think about the wisdom of doing this particular project under these circumstances. And I remember, taking chapters and research and showing it to my wife and my friends and family and saying, look at this amazing thing. This is what we're learning. Mm-hmm. And they would say, are you doing this thing? Because you need this thing right now. You need to do this. You need to stop what you're doing right now. Put down the computer and, go do a little contemplative practice for a while. Mm-hmm. And so the good news is we ended up with two beautiful children, a wonderful partner in my professional life appeared. We managed to survive the great crisis and continue to thrive and grow. I certainly found that some of the lessons of the things we learned were hugely important. My resilience in that time was emboldened enormously by my social network and by the ability of that to be honest with that network about what was going on. Mm-hmm. And to be clear to this, the community I live with is a kind of a gift economy. And one of the most important, sort of the first two rules of all social networks, the first one is you build them before you need them. And the second is you root them in an initial act of generosity. You give to them before you expect anything from them. Otherwise, you're just inviting people over to paint your house and do your homework, and that's usually no fun. So we had done a lot of that, and I found great wisdom in being able to use some of the contemplative practices in particular. And I'm the kind of person who, if there's a kind of a visual definition of the guy with the monkey mind, you're talking to him. So this was a really serious change for me. And we made it through. And, like everything, not without cost and consequence and reversals. Right. But
to know that that was part of the picture, is there something just in that acknowledgement, in that as your base of reality and expectation, that does that help?
I think it was helpful to me in the process of working on a project on resilience to experience fear and doubt and genuine pain.
Right.
To understand why people curl in on themselves in the face of disruption, you know,
reasonable, in a sense, that is.
That
right?
is exactly when every pore of your being is screaming out to turn away, right? And you can see in some ways to move from my own personal narrative, which I made a very conscientious decision not to write about it in the book because really for two reasons. One is I thought it was a little indulgent for me, and also because I think there are really important exemplars of this that you know needed to be front and center. But what I will say is that in the context of our politics and our society, we have moved from a period where we felt invulnerable. We lived in a bubble.
Yeah.
We were in control. We were masters of our fate, even if we were subject to, you know, all kinds of politics. And I'm talking about as a society.
You said somewhere it wasn't the end of history. It was a vacation from history. That's
right.
Good.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. It was a long scenic car ride.
Right.
and so in the middle of all that, we have now arrived at a place where we discover we're not as in control as we thought we were. We're not as invulnerable as we thought we were. We won't solve every problem. We don't have unlimited resources. The decisions of our leadership are not, prescient and perfect. They're sloppy and complicated, and all of the things we've talked about. And in an environment like that, to come into the whirlwind, when you find yourself in trouble, there are two instincts. And in many ways, these instincts are at war in our society right now, or they're in conflict in our society. Mm-hmm. One instinct is to push through the maelstrom into a new reality and to push forward from the known in the midst of, you know, we're not in Kansas and we're not in Oz. We're in the whirlwind. And in the whirlwind, you know, one instinct is to go forward and find the new place and find the new reality that exists on the other side. And another is to turn back. And turning back is not retreat.
Right.
If you've ended up in a bad place, turning back is often the wise path, you know, the wisest path. And we have a deep structural debate in our society about which of those paths to take. And we tend, the folks who are pushing forward look at those who say turn back and say it's impossible, right? You're yearning after a world that didn't exist in the first place. And the folks who say turn back, who look at the folks who say push forward through the maelstrom, saying you're letting go of the coherence of who we've been and who we are and not being inclusive. And that is the debate between a world that is defined at the polar ends by Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party and
right.
politics between Democrats and Republicans and progressives and conservatives and on and on and on. So, you know, the goal, I think, for us is to find deep agreement. It's to go back to those principles of seeing the other fully for whom they are, and to find those places of those places where we can cooperate in the near term to reduce the impacts of the maelstrom, particularly on the weakest among us, because those are not, many of those activities are not political. They're not things that require big changes in policy. They can be executed through lots of different
right.
public
we
and
don't,
private things.
We don't need the political system to be working at
yeah that's
great.
Right.
Wonderfully to do all of this. So I wonder if that gets at something, the meaning of something. You've written the journey toward resilience is the great moral quest of our age. And I want you to answer that also as a person of your generation, and you're in your 40s, right? And I think you're working with a lot of people who are also in their 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
Tell me about how you and this generation think about that term morality in this context of what we're learning about ourselves as brains and bodies and societies. And
well, there are, I will say, one of the things that's a shift for our generations. I grew up in the generation that normalized divorce.
Yeah.
Where families began to fragment before parenting was completed, right?
Yeah.
That's the MTV generation. It's a very particular cohort in time. And so, you know, people at that time, they essentially forecast doom for the American family and for young people.
As we're doing again now.
Right. We would all be broken people.
Yeah.
Right. So look at the generation that we got right after mine. Their ranks are swelling with social innovators and social entrepreneurs. You know, I went to go speak at a high school recently, and the kids said, "Yeah, well, we're trying to develop this program in this literacy program in rural Africa." I said, "Aren't you in ninth grade? What was I doing in ninth grade? I wasn't doing this in ninth grade." So there is a sense in which, in some ways, first of all, some of it's a fad. But I think much of it is very genuine, and I think there's a sense in which these are children and young people who've grown up in an era of information ubiquity, a sense of real disruption and vulnerability, and yet they've maintained a kind of cheerful earnestness.
A cheerful earnestness. Yes.
Yeah, a desire to want to make impact. Now, the challenge for many of them is that they're working on what we call wicked problems, which are big, complex, interdependent, and they've earned the moniker wicked for a reason.
Yeah.
They're really hard. You pull one string in the giant hairball, and six or seven other things happen. And it's sometimes you're not making the situation better. Sometimes you can, in trying to make it better, actually make it worse. But that said, I think there is a sense in which
I'm sorry, I got to interrupt for 1 second. It's Paul.
Okay.
Yeah.
Krista, we're really running out of time.
We have
3 o'clock, and I've been holding them.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know that when we said we
so
could keep
going.
Can we
wrap it up?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Cadence
yeah.
On
yeah.
This
so sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't know there was a 3 o'clock.
Plug on you without an ending.
Okay. All right.
I was so enjoying this. It's like getting into a warm bath talking to you, Krista.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize there was a stop. Okay.
Should we stop now, or do you want me to conclude the thought?
Yeah, no, finish the thought, yeah.
Okay. So I think there's a sense that there's a bias toward action. I think that there is a sense that this is an age that is defined by challenges that are not as well understood by the older generation. And I think really importantly, among people in their 20s and their 30s, they grew up in a world of normalized social networks in which they're sort of profligate networkers. They're constantly connecting to each other. And I think it's less a generation of superstars than super teams. There's a sense that they have to work together. And so I think that is incredibly exciting. And, you know, I am warmed by their enthusiasm. And even if sometimes what they're doing is naive, you have a sense that when this generation begins to really crack the code, they're going to have an enormous impact.
Mm. All right. That's a great last word. Andrew, thank you. This was so wonderful. Paul, I'm sorry. I did not get that message. And we'll let you know what's happening with this, and you and I will be in touch. Okay. Thank you.
Let's talk on the phone, because I want to talk to you about a few things at the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll do that. Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.